Hello and welcome to Kingdom Quest episode 423. I am your technically inept host, Mike Epps, aka Wheels, with me as always.
Tired. What episode are we on?
423.
I thought we did 423 last week. Am I confused?
No, that's 422.
No. Stop doing this to me. 423 locked.
Oh. Well, I guess the show is over.
Yeah, that status means locked.
Okay. Not understanding a word of what's going on. Your manager, Pan Michael Baker, Gaiji Minokatari. Are we actually having a stream?
Yes, we're making. We've been making jokes about HTTP errors because they're all in the 400s.
Well, like any error that says like you can't get this information is a 400 error.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like some of these, basically no one has ever. You're going to see these basically once in a very blue moon. But 423 law error means that the resource has been locked in some fashion. Which is different from a forbidden. I like that locked and forbidden are distinct. That's fun to me.
Fireminer, you found us.
Yay!
No,
we didn't find us.
No, we will be back on the RP Gamer account once I fix.
We all fucked up.
I messed up my Streamlabs.
Nice job.
We'll be back there next week. Apologies.
Nice job, dipshit.
Dude, you had one job.
But yeah, let's. So yeah, welcome to the machine.
I played Marvel Cosmic Invasion about an hour ago.
That makes you sound like a fucking nerd. Did you play as Beta Ray Bill?
I did not, but my son did.
Well, someone should have.
I was Rocket and Black Panther.
Nerd.
As you'd expect, the game is very good. If you like Shredder's Revenge, you'll like this game.
I do like Shredder's Revenge.
Like, half the characters are locked right off the bat. Including Phoenix, which I'm not happy about.
I feel like it makes sense that half the characters are locked. There's like 20 of them.
Yeah, 15.
Like, that's a lot of characters for a beat-em-up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very fun. It's very pretty. Yeah, it's a good time.
It's what you'd expect from Tribute at this stage.
The campaign mode seems a little simpler as far as the map goes, but I think it looks like there's going to be a lot more stages. Some of them are shorter. But yeah, it's a good time. Lots of crazy cosmic shenanigans. Don't know who some of the characters are.
Such as?
I forget. I don't even remember the names.
Cool.
The Beetle is the boss of the first stage.
Not to be confused with the Blue Beetle. Wrong company.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then there's you fight Master Mold and yeah. Looks like it's going to go all over.
You're saying there's some deep cuts involved here.
Yes. There's deep cuts and, like, Wolverine and Storm look like they're pulled directly from, like, the Marvel vs. Capcom series. Like, they aren't, because the sprites obviously fit in well with the game, but they're very much modeled after those characters. And I think it's
a lot of interpretations among nerds.
I think it's what's his name doing Wolverine's voice.
Loom?
No, Solid Snake. Yeah. Whatever his name is.
Vader?
I think so.
That's weird. I don't recall him ever doing that voice before, but maybe I just haven't been paying attention.
Or whoever did the voice in Marvel vs. Capcom.
I thought it was. I mean, at the time, At the time, it was mostly Steve Bloom, I think.
Okay, then it's probably him. The other characters all sound like voice actors that played those characters in recent games, like Ultimate Alliance and other ones like that. Like, whoever does the voice for Black Panther is definitely the same one from Ultimate Alliance.
Wolverine is apparently played by, if this internet search is to be believed, is portrayed by Cal Dodd.
Don't know who that is.
He was the Wolverine circa, like, original MVC.
Okay. So I was right that it's the same guy.
You were right. This is horrible.
It's okay. Embrace it.
It does happen sometimes.
It's very rare.
Yeah, not much more to say about it other than that. It's exactly what you expect.
You saw the trailer. You know what you're looking at.
Yeah. For good and... I mean, I don't want to say for ill, but I mean, if you don't like those games, it would be. But this is exactly what you would expect. It seems like a good time, and I'm guessing there's probably going to be some DLC at some point, so.
It's probably a good bet.
Yeah. I got the Switch 1 version to play on more systems, and it runs at 60 frames per second, and honestly seems to run better than Turtles did, so.
And it's a shell of a time.
It's under a gigabyte, so.
It's a shell of a time. Yeah, I mean, that looks fun enough. Gajan, what have you been playing?
Well, I just finished up Stray Children the other day for the second time through.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The English translation simultaneously makes it easier to read and while not actually helping to explain anything that's going on, which is completely appropriate for this game.
This is correct.
It is just that kind of game. Though, I did realize through the English translation that the Fifth Kingdom in the game actually makes an extended Rule of Rose reference.
Oh, Lord. Okay, yeah, I suppose the Love of Dalek. Some things never die.
Yeah, Love of Dalek, yeah. Well, enough, either there's some things that are a little variable at one point in the game, or they took out a visual reference to Dandy Dungeon. I remember that being in there.
Huh.
Didn't see it the second time. Not quite sure what happened there. Maybe it was just blinking and missed it. But yeah, it's a fun game. It's interesting to see how much of the closing credits is dedicated to the kooky voice actors. Just because, as I recall, they did an open casting call on the Onion Games Discord. Or anybody who wanted to submit voice samples for remixing, just do it. Because the quote-unquote voice acting in this game is very similar to Moon RPG Remix Adventure, where it was originally a voice, and then it got chopped up, remixed, and turned into a... that is recognizably some sort of language, while being complete gibberish. Like, you could tell that one voice actor was probably French at some point. Things like that. But there's like literally 12 to 15 pages. I mean, screens of voice actors listed in this game. A lot of them under internet handles rather than actual names. And then the very first thing after that is special minch or special thanks go to, and very top of the list of that is Toby Fox.
Naturally.
Yes. Because, again, this game... it's definitely Onion Papa's game. It is definitely in keeping with everything that Love of Metallic has ever made. And it's also quite definitely inspired by Undertale. there is a lot of similarity going on in there. For, like, just the combat and a few other things.
That's fitting.
Yep. Anyway, strongly recommend, but I also hold by the statement I made in my original deep look, being that this is not intended to be a game for everyone. It is intended to be a game that really amused the guys making it. So
hello.
So I look at it on Steam and see it's got like a 3.5 out of 5 stars overall on Steam. I'm like, yes, this is perfectly in keeping with what I know of this game.
Checks out.
I would find it concerning if, and perhaps disheartening, if something produced by any former Love the Leak individual was mainstream enough to be like universal praise.
I mean, yes, we're talking about the group of weirdos who, after Lovedelic broke up, they went on to make things like Chulip, Chibi-Robo, Rule of Rose, and Tingle's Rosy Rupee Land.
Oh god, they made that too.
Tingle's Rosy Rupee Land.
The guys who made Rosy Rupee Land were they did work on Moon at some point.
Yeah.
It's just I remember when the Moon remake came out and Famitsu Magazine had an inset with that was just a family tree charting Lovedelic and all the guys who went into it and all the guys who came out of it and which games they worked on before and since. And you had games like Romancing Saga 2 and Super Mario RPG in the roots, and then you had all these other games branching out from it, and it's in, like, crazy.
If you know what you're looking for, it's generally pretty easy to spot them, since they're all kind of still trying to, like, they're all kind of still doing variations on what they were doing at Love the Leak.
Like, we just say they just love experimental weirdness.
Experimental weirdness. They love that, like, the entire, like, love structure that Moon had, like, shows up over and over.
Yeah.
This element of having, like, essentially a meter that is used to determine how much you can do, where what you want to do in any given day to grow it is helping people with menial tasks and chores. Like, that just shows up over and over and over.
Wheels, I messaged you my stream key in Discord.
Okay. At this point, I'm probably going to have to just wait till next week. I don't want to have to stop and restart the stream.
Okay, yeah, no, I was just running a bit late, but okay. Oh, I saw your message. Alright. Sorry. Continue.
But yeah, so it's good to see that they're still shining on those crazy diamonds. Another one to throw on that list is Captain Rainbow, which is also built entirely in the same vein as those as well. But I'm looking forward to starting that, but like, I bought it, I just haven't like set myself up as like, okay, this is my committed next game yet. But I'm looking forward to it. It's
automatically updated to have English for me.
That's good.
So I've played this game in 2 different languages, and I can't really say which one it made more sense in. Actually, I can, because some of the conversation clues for the enemies did not translate well.
That's rough. Yeah. It's not surprising, but it's rough.
Yeah, I mean, there was one later on that I had to double check through an English guide. And the guy who wrote the English guide himself said, yeah, I don't know why it's this order, because I had to brute force it to figure out what was going on. And then I looked it up in the Japanese guide again to remind myself, and, oh yeah, the opening thing that you say to this character is basically a pun on the fact that the words for to ignore and bug sound exactly the same in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say somebody's ignoring the stoplight, you say Shingo Mushi.
Mm.
And the opening line, the opening bit of conversation to this enemy who looks or who has the head of a stoplight is basically about how people are bugs. And again, this makes absolutely no sense until you realize that it's a really convoluted pun on people who don't pay attention to stoplights.
Wow.
Yep. That kind of thing.
Real quick, in Zelda 2, there's a guy who says, "I am error." And there's another guy named Bagu, and I was just reading that he's supposed to say, "I am bug." So one guy is error, one guy is bug. Is that true?
Yeah. I don't know. That's accurate. That's the Japanese developer's idea of a clever name game.
Okay. Circa mid-80s.
They get better at it later on.
I mean, they clearly just were not used to having to fill out background chatter like they hadn't really done it before.
Yeah.
But...
And then I want to say in Spanish, I think Bicho is bug. Mm-hmm. So one time, so my brother-in-law is from Spain, speaks fluent Spanish, and when he first started dating my sister, at one point she was being annoying, and he said "bicho," and she's like, "What did you just call me?" So, pretty funny.
And somehow it worked out in the end.
Oh yeah, no, they live together in Spain and benefit from an amazing healthcare system. God
damn. All right.
Yeah.
You're getting pinged. As for me, I decided that now was the time to finally jump into Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth.
Is the wealth infinite?
It's good. My Ichiban is destitute for me at this point. Not completely destitute. He's got like $1,500 in his pockets, which is not that bad, but he doesn't have really a bank account to get to, so you win some, you lose some. I just started chapter 4 of that. Still a little ways away from getting to the job system, but, enjoying it so far. I mean, if you liked Like a Dragon 7, aka Yakuza Like a Dragon, this is basically the it has a very similar gameplay system, but with some good updates, specifically to make the positional elements of the combat system a little more usable. And it's fun. It's a fun game. It's well written. It's got a lot of fun side content. I honestly wish that the Crazy Taxi, Crazy Delivery minigame had better rewards, because I'd like the excuse to play it more. But that's fun. I think I'm supposed to unlock Dandoko Island soon, which is another just big ol' update. Another game spanning mini game. So much to consider, much to unpack, but I'm enjoying it. No one should be surprised at this damage.
Okay. Also, yeah. I need to decide what I'm putting on my Switch next.
Oh, that's an important question with many answers. Because
I seem to have received yet another game in the mail, so I actually have a backlog of things received from a certain source in the mail. And the choices in this case are, or depends on how far back I want to go, because I've got Breath of the Wild, Dragon Quest III, and now Pokemon ZA.
That is an embarrassment.
I'm Legends.
Goddamn.
Yeah, I know. There's only so much time in the year.
Well, ZA isn't super long as far as Pokemon games go. It's pretty breezy. Those other two games could devour your time.
Yep. Considering the last game played from the source was Persona 5 Royale.
Speaking of games that are super long.
Yep.
I mean, I guess Breath of the Wild technically isn't that long, but you will probably spend a lot of time
watching. No one's ever played it short.
Yeah, no.
Not on their first run through.
Okay.
What's Joe been playing?
Well, today I got a package. I ordered some Black Friday stuff. Yeah. So, pardon me. I got Sonic Racing Cross Worlds today.
Sweet.
Sonic.
So I went with the PS5 version because it has crossplay on all platforms. It's on sale for $45. Physical copy. It's like, all right, let's grab that. And so, of course, on my very first Grand Prix, I just did the first race on the lowest difficulty just to, you know, to learn the game. And I played as Charmy B because he's awesome. He was the one good thing about Knuckles Chaotix.
That's the one. You're the one person I've ever heard express this opinion.
Really? Charmy B?
He's awesome. He reminds me of the Honey Nut Cheerios B. Yeah.
It says B and it has a picture of a bee on it.
Let's be friends. So I got first place and I'm like, okay, this game isn't so hard. And then that unlocked the free updates where you get Joker, Ichiban, and Hatsune Miku. Yes. And then I said, okay, I'm good at this game. Let me upgrade it to the next difficulty level. And then it was like, nope. You get bombarded with items. It's crazy.
This ain't a Nintendo game, son. Prepare for pain.
That's the point where it's like, oh, this ain't Mario Kart no more. Nope.
Yeah. No, but Mario Kart doesn't get...
Right, Mario Kart doesn't get hard till 150cc, but this is like, nope, this is like the 100cc equivalent in this game is hard. So, but still, you know, got to learn the racers and the cars and get points to unlock more parts to customize my vehicles. And there's just so much cool stuff in the game. It's very chaotic, and I think it could take some getting used to. It can be very jarring if you're coming over from Mario Kart World. But I like, you know, I definitely want to keep playing. I do like it. And got a good deal on it. And then I also got a 5 terabyte external hard drive for a good deal, so I'm in the process of backing some stuff up that was not backed up, and I was kind of pressing my luck there for a while. And I thought, you better get everything backed up.
That's too many terabytes.
Yeah, and this should also free up space on my other drives that were being used for backup purposes, and I got plans, that's all I'm saying. I just copied some important stuff over, but I got some plans for other things I can do. Like, I might finally digitize my whole DVD collection. Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe.
And let me think. What else have I played in the past week? I mean, I finished my Bloodstained Randomizer run on Tuesday night. Yeah, so I got to the point where I'm like, oh, okay, I just need the Zangetsudo to get to the final area. I already had, like, they gave me the dimension shift pretty early. It was like, okay, so as soon as I found Zangetsudo, and it was in a pretty obvious place that I could have checked earlier, and it's like, oh, well, but I was higher level and had better spells anyways and made the final area easier. Then in the last two areas, that's where they gave me high jump and double jump. And I'm like, well, that would have been useful a long time ago. But basically, that's what I've kind of learned, is if you can find Dimension Shift and Zangetsudo, you can beat the game. So that was fun. And then Thursday, of course, no stream because of Thanksgiving, and then going back to Pokemon this weekend. I did play a little bit of Legend ZA, so I'm ready to continue the story on my next live stream and try to go to the next rank. I think I'm C, so now I got to beat the rich girl at the dinner party to get to B, I think. And then just been catching a lot of Pokemon. And last night we did some Pokemon Scarlet and had to trade Pokemon, and then we got our asses kicked by a 5-star Lapras a few times, but I finally just turned my Pawmot into like just a wrecking machine and took out that stupid Lapras. So it worked out.
Also, I changed my level 100 Arceus, which I probably should
have. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why that took you so long.
Yeah, so that worked out in the end. Oh, I got Oblivion remastered because I love that janky ass game, let me tell you. And the remaster, just better graphics, better performance, some of the same old jank, but fully revamped leveling system that's more like Skyrim, and I'm having a ball with it, really. Really having fun. And I also got... I never pronounce it correctly. Kanitsugami. That's that Capcom game. Yeah.
Kanitsugami.
Yep, so that's the Capcom game that's like part action game, part tower defense. You have to guide the goddess to the portal and protect her as monsters come out to try to murder her. So I decided to buy that too. So at this point, I don't want Game Pass Ultimate. I'm not paying $30 a month. And especially if there's only a handful of games I want to play. So now I'm just waiting for each of those games to go on sale. And so, you know, I got Doom Dark Ages like a few months ago. I got, you know, Oblivion Remastered. So then the only other Game Pass Ultimate games I would want to play are probably like Avowed, Indiana Jones, and South of Midnight. So yeah, I'm not paying $360 a year or whatever just to... It's like, oh, I see what they did there, right? $30 a month. Oh, that's $360 a year. Yeah.
Lame.
So, yeah. And I've decided I'm just gonna...
$360 a year to get that terrible Halo remake.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and that unnecessary re-remaster of Gears of War 1. Yeah. Whoopity-doo.
I'm done with my...
So,
okay, so, I guess it's the last thing about what we played. I'll bring up the Man Wheels had a good time playing Kirby Air Riders yesterday.
Oh, yeah, very chaotic. Weekend.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
I won all three races.
True.
I want to play as Ricky. Hey, Ricky, you're so fine. You're so fine. You blew my mind. Hey, Ricky. Ricky the
Hammer. Just for this, I'm going to dig up the Japanese version of the song and just play it at you too much at some point.
Not okay. Ready for that. Okay, we've got an abbreviated schedule, so I want to hit some of what Firemind has been asking so patiently. See, last week Gaijin talked about how Umamusume, by virtue of having its characters based on real-world horses, stood out more compared to other gacha game characters. The thing with Umamusume is that it suffers from a case of ludonarrative constraint. The main mode of the game is the character stories, wherein you play as a horse girl's trainer, trying to guide your trainee through their 3 years of high school and the horse girl races. Jesus, why is it a high school? Whatever, I can probably guess that one. Character stories have preset goals and pretty limited gameplay strategies. One consequence of this is how it limits the story being told. Almost all these character stories follow a formula. It can be boiled down to, you're here to iron out the flaws and the trauma of the Hearth Girls, so they can be the champion as they always should have. Every character is the protagonist, basically. That's why most games are constructed mechanically and narratively on the assumption that the gamer's gonna win. But what about examples in non-computer RPGs? The game was written to cover the scenarios where the gamer loses. What interesting story can you write in those cases? Case in point, Dark Savior and Triangle Strategy. Like, you can write a lot of interesting you can write a lot of interesting stories that function on player failure. You can find some weird ones back in the day. I want to say, like, Wing Commander and Colony Wars both had, like, story branches that were built around, well, you fucked up that mission, let's see where you go next. That was pretty common, but ultimately what those ended up producing, and I think part of, like, obviously part of the reason you don't do this is that most players don't like the idea of, I got a bad ending because I was bad at the game. Players typically don't like that. It's also just really punishing, which is part of why you don't end up seeing that often. Like, if it does produce some interesting options by dint of, like, you can shepherd players into an expected path by simply introducing a difficulty spike. But again, the players often don't respond well to that. But I think one of the other things that you kind of lose without... one of the things that opens up to you if you, you know, have these story branches that come from specifically player failure is that you get these options for players having to make more difficult decisions. Like, say that a player... you know, say you fuck up a mission, you can potentially put decisions in front of the player about, like, maybe you can recover the resource you lost by fucking up that mission, but you're going to have to sacrifice something else. You can put interesting choices in front of the player on that basis that have more of a narrative weight to them because you know you're the reason that it fucked up. But you know, ultimately, it's hard to get players on board with that. A lot of them will just quit. But I do think that, like, some of those old, like, for some reason, this was seemingly just sort of common in, like, space war games at the time. But you can run into those. I think. Yeah, some of those old Wing Commander games definitely had this. Like I said, Colony Wars definitely had this. Those were a franchise that was kind of a big deal for about 7 minutes. Only Colony Wars. Anyone remember that?
Colony Wars. I remember Colony Wars.
Yeah, there were like three of those: Colony Wars, Colony Wars Vengeance, and Colony Wars Red Sun. Like. This thing, it was made by Psygnosis, which ended up being like Sony Europe by that point, basically. And then they never even talked about making another one after the PlayStation ended. It's very strange.
Very weird.
But yeah, those were kind of interesting for that, if you're looking for those branching narratives based on player success or failure. I recall Vengeance in particular. All of them are balls hard because Psygnosis didn't know how to make a game that wasn't balls hard. But Vengeance, I recall being like particularly just flagrantly cruel. You are not going to get a good ending in your first attempt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is kind of an interesting branch. It's very. A lot of design possibilities get closed off by trying to avoid bad feel. But, yeah, let's see. Yeah, Colony Wars Vengeance has one good ending and five bad endings, depending upon if you fucked up certain missions. To the point where, like, there are just entire sections of the campaign where it's like, well, you fucked up that mission and now you get this bad ending. But yeah, an interesting concept. The thing with triangle strategy here is that losing does not mean utter defeat. It can mean you don't get the most optimized result that you desire. It emphasizes the weight of your choices. I previously complained about Persona social links feel like a game of social engineering for stats and power-ups, and Wheel suggested that there could be bad social links that gave you nothing or even harmed you.
How much would Persona fans hate that kind of mechanic? Yeah, we kind of got into this a little already, but yeah. These things have gone away. Like, Persona used to have ways to... Like, there weren't bad social links, but there were absolutely ways to fuck yourself over by just saying the wrong thing at the wrong time in Persona 3. And that just went away immediately, because no one wanted that.
Or looking farther back to Shin Megami Tensei and all the ways you could twist your way to a different ending. It was a lot more interesting earlier on.
It was interesting, but it was also one of those things where, like, one player out of 10 might reach the interesting because the other 9 got driven off, and that's why we don't see that anymore. And that's kind of, you know, like, the more mass appeal a title, the more it's going to have to throw out these things that just sort of, like... piss off.
And in the case of Megaton, I can imagine that simply trying to recreate some of the interactions from Shin Megami Tensei the original would be horribly cost inefficient for Shin Megami Tensei 5.
Yeah, I mean, you run into the budgetary thing of, like, because making branches costs more to generate at this point, it's harder to justify making a branch that happens because you fucked up in a particularly interesting fashion.
Or also because they had better faction elements earlier on. So you could do things like, okay, you recruited a crusader and then you merged him with something else to create a werewolf, and that will automatically ding you a couple points on alignment to that particular faction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had creative ways. Mess things up.
Yeah. The other thing I would bring up regarding these... What was I about to say? Another situation where, like, fucking up could produce mildly interesting results, but you end up with creating just an extremely opaque system that I've never heard a single person enjoy. It's like how Shin Megami Tensei ifs, like... it's quote-unquote persona system works, where, like, you'll get new ones by fucking dying, but
you have to, like, make sure that you last long enough to build up good karma so that your next persona will actually be better.
Yeah, like, that's the problem, is that it sends you into a tailspin. Because likely as not, the reason that you died is that you weren't strong enough before, and there's a decent chance that you now have something weaker. But yeah, that's the other thing with these, is that they can... is that this kind of thing can produce tailspins for the player. Like, the player is having... ultimately, you run into this issue of the player is having trouble, so they get worse things. They get less resources, and inevitably have more trouble. And that can be very hard to justify for anything that is not...
Fire Emblem!
Yeah, that can be very hard to justify. Another game that's that can do variations of this is some of the Way of the Samurai games. You can get yourself into extreme amounts of trouble by doing very silly things. And they get away with that because a playthrough of a Way of the Samurai game is usually about 2 hours. But, like, I remember one of the things that was fun that they had did with 3, I think I've talked about this before, Way of the Samurai 3 introduced a button that it was just a dedicated unsheath your sword button, but it worked during cutscenes. And so... characters would react to the fact that you had just unsheathed your sword at a very inappropriate time as a tacit threat.
Oh no.
So you could do things like essentially emergent subterfuge, where you would like, the game wasn't telling you hey, you could try now that you're here, you could try now that you've got an audience with this politically powerful person, you could try attacking them. It's just giving you a button that says, okay, I'm in the presence of a politically powerful person. Now I'm going to attempt to kill them because I pulled my sword out. Which was kind of fun. But you could also just fuck that up, and so you end up running for your life, and that leaves you with technically worse off than you started, but again, this is a 3-hour game.
Mm-hmm.
3-hour game. Three-hour
game.
Many games have made fun of completionists and achievement hunters, but which game does it best? I think it might actually be Bullet Witch on the Xbox 360. A game with essentially no... a few other good points, except that it has one very funny achievement. So there are only like 14 achievements for Bullet Witch, and they are things like clear the stages, easy difficulty, normal difficulty, hard difficulty, chaos difficulty. Total playtime of 15 plus hours. But the thing that's evil here is that if you're playing a significant amount, you'll get that total playtime of 15 plus hours. That is an achievement worth 99 points. The achievement for beating the hardest difficulty is worth a single point. It is just fucking with you. It exists like... Both sides of that equation are funny. If you just beat the game without getting that... If you manage to beat that hardest difficulty without hitting 15 hours, you have a solitary point for your troubles. If you reach 15 hours of the game played without beating that difficulty, you have the incredibly irritating... Because very few games ever use the one point. Like the one, you know, like you might get some fives. You wouldn't, it was very rare to get like non-five or zero in that last digit. And Bullet Witch could absolutely put a player in a position where they had either a nine or a one. And that's very funny. I think that's the most fun way of directly trolling that. Like there's no broader purpose. It's just fucking with you for spending all that for going to that much trouble, because hell difficulty was basically like if you get shot once you're dead.
Oh wow.
It was brutal. So yeah, like that hell mode, just to get your numbers back to a normal number. It's like being punished for having played Bullet Witch. So that's my personal favorite. There's some other ones that are funny. Some of these are funny but weren't intentional. Like these are accidental trolls. A bunch of EA's first achievements, back when like the idea of what achievements should be were still being figured out, a bunch of them were like, be number one in the world online rankings for Madden or Tiger Woods. And it's what the fuck you? That's not happening. So some of those like achievements that were like legitimately nearly impossible to get. Five people might have this. But yeah, those are the ones that stick out to me. You get other ones that are just like mocking the very idea of them, like the way that you can just buy all of the trophies in Nier Automata, but I have more respect for situations where like no, we have punished you for attempting to get these.
Hold on, is Nier Automata, is there one where you keep trying to look up her skirt and then she kills you and then you get an achievement?
I don't think she kills you, but like you do definitely get an achievement for doing it.
Yeah, that's what popped in my head right away.
Which mostly exists to like alert everyone on your friends list to what you were attempting to do.
but I only did it for the achievement, I swear.
Sure.
Listen, no one was like, no one believes you. But yeah, So yeah, there's a few of these that are good. Again, Bullet Witch ends up my favorite just for attempting to destroy OCD players. God, there's an entire, like... That actually, there were a few arcade games way back in the day. There were a few, like, arcade games where instead of taking your score away when you credit fed, it just incremented the ones place. So it was obvious how many times you'd had to credit feed. Because, like, you know, you might only, you might only have, you know, like, ways to score in increments of 100. So it's very easy to tell how much you had to credit feed to finish. So there's that little asterisk in your high score.
Yeah, I'm thinking about games where you get an achievement when you die the first time, and obviously there's people who wouldn't be happy with that. Like Dark Souls.
Okay, something I'm thinking of here. Do you remember Neopets?
I do.
At one point, Neopets had a Flash-based, like, basically, like, their own version of Dragon Quest, the original. Mm-hmm. Very similar. And aside from the fact that it was possible to softlock yourself at the very end of the game without any option for to buy new healing items in front of the final boss, it also had a trophy that you could get for dying to the very first enemy of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's nice. Just what I thought there. It's like, yeah. And since it was tied to your account, you couldn't actually reset progress on the thing.
Yeah.
So the only way to get this particular trophy for your page in Neopets like 20 years ago was to intentionally let yourself die to the first weakest enemy of the game. And if you just went in and not knowing this, then if you were in any way, shape, or form a completionist, you're like, oh no, I'm never getting that. So...
I remember the first time I got an achievement that was designed specifically to mock me in a video game. It was the port of Fear to the original, to the Xbox 360, where if you blew yourself up with a grenade 5 times, you would get a 0-point achievement called Suicide King.
Oh.
And I had not contemplated that idea, but... Yeah, that was a funny troll achievement. I enjoyed that, actually. Okay, I want to hit a few more of Fire Miner's questions, because, again, we are quite limited on time, so let's hit a few more of these. Back to Umamusume. A lot of Toho fans never engage with the actual games because they just aren't a fan. Same problem with Umamusume. The game itself is pretty monotonous, so what you've got are Uma fans who treat the games as, at best, a way to support side games so that they can make anime and manga adaptations which tell much more interesting stories. How many multimedia franchises have exceeded in spite of the original work's middling quality? Token Ranbu is a very similar example. I feel like we probably, this is a playing with fire subject? I'm trying to think of anything that I'd feel comfortable just, like, blasting in this fashion. Because, like, the prerequisites here are, like, strong fan following that, despite extreme mediocrity.
Yes.
So who do we want to piss off?
Yeah, I might have to come back to this one while I think about this. Because I also, like... Mediocre is, to me, so much more damning than terrible, because terrible usually implies that you were trying something and fucked up. I suppose if I wanted to like, pull my immediate bias, I would... And this is still a pretty limited form of success. I mean, obviously, this is very much a cult-following thing, but my first thought would be Neptunia.
Yeah, that's fair.
There are, like, a billion of those... I've never heard of anyone who was more than like, this game in the franchise is pretty decent, pretty okay. But there's a billion of them. And it's really
not very good.
Yep, and ultimately, like, it just comes down to People find the concept charming. People will find individual character charming. So that would be the thing that I would think of as... but that's even that's kind of cheating, because it's like, yes, it is a multimedia franchise, but like it's still mostly a game. It has media spinoffs, but like it's not like there's other versions of Neptunia that like other non-game versions of Neptunia that are like blowing the doors off the joint.
I mean, I think most Neptunia fans would admit that most of the games are terrible.
Yeah, I've never heard of anyone who's like willing to defend them unequivocally.
The main games are fine, meaning after the PS3 era, starting with the
all the PS3 ones are irredeemable garbage.
Yes,
all of them.
I haven't actually played them very much on the PS3. So yes, Vita and onwards, the main series games are pretty good. 2, I would say, is really good. And the spin-off games are a pile of shit. For the most part. It's an occasional entertaining thing. Like that, like that weird 2D game that was made by a French studio. Do you remember that one?
Super Neptunia?
Yeah, that one was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's fun. Then, it's fine.
Then there was Hyper Dimension Senran Kagura, that didn't have as much horniness as Senran Kagura, and it was like, okay, this is cool. I thought that was kind of neat.
That one's pretty good.
Yeah. So I was gonna say, you know, the first Disgaea game wasn't great, and the games have gotten consistently better for the most part. But then I realized it's not really a successful franchise, is it? Because you know,
it's not multimedia. That's where we keep running into these. Like,
there's an anime.
Okay. Like, there was a Disgaea anime. It was not a success.
And there was manga. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, ultimately, those still exist as advertisements for the game. It doesn't feel like a full multimedia franchise.
And I was just thinking how like the Alien movies are like the opposite of what he described. Like the first one was quite good, and I don't know how that series keeps getting more funding to do more shitty movies. Like, I don't know.
Watching them. okay. To hit another one of these, the recent re-release of R-Type Delta is actually a native port and not emulation, and it brings its own problems. Slowdown is gone, and the game now has a bit of vertex warping. I'm pretty sure it already had that, but... because that's just how PS1 games tend to go. I've got to ask, the people who can notice those differences, are they really the customers of re-releases and services like virtual consoles? Are they hardcore enough to just hang on to the original hardware? So there's two things at play here. First of all, yeah, I do want to bring up that like the slowdown is gone is actually a bad thing for some old school shooters, R-Type Delta among them. Not just because it makes the game harder, which it does, but also because there are sequences in the game that are intended to have their music timed to the speed the game is known to run at. And so there are points in R-Type Delta HD Boosted where it runs too fast, and the intended aesthetic resonance between on-screen action and soundscape is blunt. It's very strange. But as for the question at hand, I think that you run into a few things. Yes, you won't necessarily notice, like, a new player will not notice that things have changed, at least typically, unless you fuck up real bad. A new player is not going to have a frame of reference necessary to notice that something has changed. That said, if you fuck up enough of these, you're not a new player won't become a new fan.
Right. Yeah.
And like that's the problem you run into. Especially, you know, when you look at something like R-Type Delta, you know, that's in a niche enough genre that it needs all the help it can get.
When you were talking about games punishing you for losing, it's like that's every 90s shoot 'em up that's Gradius, that's our type. It's
yeah, but those are impermanent.
Yeah, okay, that's true. You're right.
Yeah, I was looking, casting around specifically for situations where the game continues, but okay. You're at a disadvantage for fucking up.
Okay. Gotcha.
But yeah.
So, I mean, I like R-Type. I'm not good at it.
It's really hard. Yeah.
I have R-Type Final 2, and of course the title annoys the hell out of me, but
how R-Type Final 2 got updated into R-Type Final 3.
Yeah, oh man, what's the last one going to be? I don't know, but
R-Type.
I remember getting that game and thinking, "Oh, this is a very nice looking R-Type game," and then I start dying, and I'm like, "Oh, it's still R-Type."
Someone has to play R-Type Tactics 2, Operation Bitter Chocolate.
No,
oh, no.
No one has to play that.
Yeah, I've kind of promised myself to actually be playing that eventually when it comes out.
You do owe a man.
I do owe a man, yes. Dedicate it in his memory.
Yeah. We will not abridge any discussion of R-Type Tactics when it comes out in his honor.
Yes. Okay. And so I would say I'm not hardcore enough to hang on to original hardware. I would rather emulate something if I can get some improvements out of it, but yeah, I do acknowledge that, you know, how much things would be messed up if you got higher frame rate in certain games. And actually what you were describing before about the music, it's like, imagine if someone somehow made Super Metroid run faster and then during the final boss fight the music doesn't line up. That would be just god awful. Yeah.
Yeah, like the thing we end up running into is we occasionally get these reminders of the people making these games were not ignorant of the problems.
Right. But, and there was a lot of creative problem solving going on too, which I think we've kind of lost in newer games. Yeah.
But yeah, what I would say here is that for this kind of thing, I will conclude on I'm the kind of person that loves the quote unquote problems that come with original hardware. I don't want old games to be like smoothed out or stretched out to a new resolution, blah 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 blah. I want them to run the way they ran. But I also have limited time and space. And every time that I move, the problem of keeping the hardware becomes more and more of a clear issue.
Yeah.
And so as much as I'd like to, eventually I am in certain situations, I'm going to be put in the unenviable position of I love the original look and feel. I cannot continue carrying all of those like discs, cartridges, hardware around. That is not practical. It might not even be financially feasible. And so I would theoretically be the audience for a good native port that is loyal to the original. So I guess that'd be me. That's I am who you're thinking of. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, yeah. I think one of the problems you run into, like, you know, they bring up like the Virtual Console. It's very hard to sell a new audience on buying an individually released old game.
It's right.
Extraordinarily difficult.
Yes.
You could sell them in packages. This is why Nintendo stopped trying to make Virtual Console happen, is because it's you can use it as a deal sweetener of like, look at all of these games you will be able to play if you just have Switch Online. Like that is a way you can sweeten that deal, but you can't get away. It's very hard to sell just here's an old game for $5.
Yeah, well, I was on board with that until they completely shut down the eShop and the Wii Shop channel and then the 3DS eShop. Like, yeah, I was on board with that on the Wii, but then after I lost everything, it was like, oh, screw this. I'm not giving you more money.
It's one of those situations.
They didn't honor my purchases from that era. Yeah.
It's one of those situations where, like, they dug their own grave with how they failed to set up an actual... They dug their own grave with failing to set up an actual account system. It looks like those days are finally behind us. But...
Yeah, that's good at least. What I like about, you know, Switch Online is I think that they do enough to make these games more palatable. And you have plenty of optional features, like no one's forcing you to save states or use Rewind or whatever. So yeah, it's cool that you have these optional features, these optional CRT filter, that sort of thing. So I think they've done a good job with Switch Online, but I would still like the option to do like a 16:9 stretch format. That's, you know, nobody's making you use it if you don't want it, but yeah.
Part of the reason people don't let some of those options in is that, like, you can get people will gravitate towards some really strange looks. The hatred of black bars is we need to teach people to accept black bars.
No.
Like if your other option is that you're the heathen that is playing all of your Game Boy Color games stretched on Game Boy Advance, I don't know what to do with you.
Sorry.
You're not sorry enough.
I'm not sorry at all.
Well, then why did you say sorry then?
I don't know.
And I might be in a minority.
In your heart, you know you have sinned.
No, I haven't.
I might be a minority here, but I thought the N64 emulation is fine on Switch. I had a blast with Ocarina of Time with some actual anti-aliasing texture filtering. You know, I don't know.
The original actually absolutely had anti-aliasing. It had too much. that is just actually just built into the N64 on the hardware level. It's very difficult to disable it. Yeah. I'm limiting myself to 10 seconds to describe this, but like, when I see games that were not widescreen forced into widescreen, I feel like I am sitting through people demanding an open mat format of every fucking movie they've ever seen. Follow-up question. The thing with R-Type Delta HD Boosted is that only 60-70% of the original source code was preserved. I'm kind of shocked that that much was still around. So the development team had to make their own code. One of the changes they made was to get rid of the slowdown. They genuinely did not foresee the negative reactions to that change. Very common. Like, there's a very famous quote. There's a pretty famous quote attributed to Brian Eno saying, "Whatever you now find weird, ugly, uncomfortable, and nasty about a new medium will surely become its signature. CD distortion, the jitteriness of digital video, the crap sound of 8-bit, all of these will be cherished and emulated as soon as they can be avoided. It's the sound of failure. So much modern art..." Something just popped onto my screen. "So much modern art is the sound of things going out of control, of a medium pushing to its limits and breaking apart. The distorted guitar sound is the sound of something too loud for the medium supposed to carry it. The blues singer with the cracked voice is the sound of an emotional cry too powerful for the throat that releases it. The excitement of grainy film, of bleached out black and white, is the excitement of witnessing events too momentous for the medium assigned to record them." This absolutely exists with games. And one of the things we run into, like, even when they're not intentional, intentional updates, like, even when there's not, like, an intentionality to the use of the cracks in the medium, we run into this over and over.
Fireminer brings up, they genuinely didn't foresee, it reminds me of the negative reaction to the version of Capcom versus SNK in the Capcom Fighting Collection being not the one the community played. There's actually a few of those, if you look at those collections. There was also, Capcom eventually patched in a toggle to turn back on a bug around Juggernaut that made him viable. because people really just were frustrated that they could not use that character properly anymore.
The fact that there's a character who requires a bug to be useful.
Yeah, so basically there was a bug that, like, one of Juggernaut's specials would give him a buff that was temporary, but if you did it under the right circumstances, it would just become permanent. And Juggernaut sucks, so he needs all the help he can get. you can now turn on the bug. I think they eventually made it so you could play the non-easy operation version of CVS2 in the Fighting Collection, which is nice. CVS2 EO fixed a bug called roll canceling that made it so that that made a lot of characters more viable. So people wanted the version of CVS2 where more characters were usable.
As you would expect. Yes.
Yeah. But roll canceling was definitely not intended to... I'm sure they were kind of aware of it, but shortly after the game's release, they were seeing it, and it's like, this is way more powerful than we thought. They patched it out. And then decades later, it's like, well, it helps more than it hurts. And I think they eventually made it so that you could play proper CVS2. Let's see. How much time do we have left, Wheels?
We can go till about 12:45. We can stretch a little longer.
About 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. You talked about how when a game comes out, it stops being the developer's sole property and the players own a part of it too, but like, what example represents the biggest gap between the developer's needs and desires and the players?
I don't know.
That's a rough one. Like, ultimately, any service game ultimately ends up kind of adversarial. Because you end up with the hardcore players who want the game to keep getting harder and to reward their like investment and mastery. And you have the developers whose needs become, we need to keep getting new players onto this. And it's very rare for those to ever come back into alignment. Yep, Destiny, Final Fantasy XIV, World of Warcraft,
Diablo like, 4, Diablo 3, yeah, really, Diablo 2.
Really, Diablo. You just run into all of these. Like, I think that's where it gets starkest, because you have the enthusiast player base that wants the game to keep getting harder, keep getting more complex, to give them the rush of what it felt like when they didn't understand how the game worked. And you have the developers who want to attract people who already found the game too intimidating, which is why they didn't start playing it earlier. And so they keep simplifying things. And that push-pull is probably the most like clear-cut example of this. You've talked about how renaming the junction system to equip would have cleared up a lot of confusion about what within Final Fantasy VIII. But what about FF8's actual equipment? Is the payoff for all the times you've to spend to upgrade the weapons worth it? Oh, it's fucking worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's like the only one who really gets a lot of worth out of upgrading their equipment as Squall, because that opens up his extra limit breaks. And his extra limit breaks are extraordinarily powerful. Everyone else, you might as well not bother. Like, some of them are more obviously useless than others, but none of them are as useful as just junctioning properly. And another reason that equip might have been a more useful verb here, especially because there's no armor in that game. There's no accessories in that game. there's absolutely, like, equip in the menu would have, I keep bringing it up, it would have immediately made it clear what the level of importance of what you were doing. But yeah, like the actual weapons, like the upgradable weapons, are such a comical mismatch between how much pain they are to get and how useful they actually are. I would never recommend that someone spend their time doing that unless they just really want to see the new low poly models. Except for Lionheart. Again, Lionheart is extraordinarily powerful. Most Japanese RPGs simplify the weapon system by the way of linear upgrades or just buying new ones. There is merit to keeping things simple, but isn't that a bit too simplistic and boring? What do you think about FF10's auto abilities and other attempts at assigning special attributes to weapons? I mean, that's usually how they sort of try to get these, to make these systems more mechanically dense. There's a lot of ways to go about this, like just trying to make these more interesting, or to essentially make it more useful to equip things that are quote-unquote suboptimal. Going back to like FF1, none of these work properly, but like FF1 has weapons that the description says they're supposed to be like, oh, this is effective against dragons, this is effective against werewolves or whatever. Fun fact, all of those are bugged. None of them work in the original version. I think in the remakes they are fixed, but in that original NES version, none of those work. But this kind of happens a lot. Actually, I just want to do a sidebar about how many different things don't work in FF1. I know we've talked about it before, but I think it's very funny.
FF1 and FF2, they were both ridiculous at times.
Yeah. FF1 is funnier to me because it has some things where it's like, just looking at it, anyone who looked at it for more than 2 minutes could have said, this doesn't make any sense. Why is it like this? My personal favorite is the spell that cures silence.
Mm-hmm.
It is I believe, defaults and in fact only functions on the caster. Sit there and think about that for 10 seconds. a lot of very strange, like, huh, don't know how you did that one. But yeah.
I'm remembering an incident where it actually worked to if you downgraded your armor for a bit. Final Fantasy IX.
Yeah.
The town with the monster arena battles.
Yeah.
The very first one could fight with just Steiner was a griffin, and for the level that you were likely going to be when it was available, you were going to get your butt kicked.
Yeah.
Except if you downgraded his armor to the slightly weaker one that you had before, which cut wind damage by 50%.
Yeah.
So mathematically, your defense was like 10 points lower than it would be with the next armor that you just upgraded to. But at the same time, the griffin only does wind damage.
Yeah. To lure back to what Fireminer was bringing up, I'll hit a few of these by name, but I will bring up FF9's way of doing this was actually just tying abilities to equipment. So you would find situations where you needed to use suboptimal equipment if you wanted to have a full complement of abilities.
And honestly, I know a lot of people really didn't like that system, but I thought it worked pretty well.
I find that fine. I think that was interesting. That is an interesting decision to put in the hands of the player. So yeah, I actually like that one. Hands So the problem I have with Tens is that it's really powerful at end game, but it does mean that the player has a lot of reasons to kind of ignore equipment in the mid game. And I think that kind of weights it in a bad way. So like most to use Tidus as an example, for most of the game, once the Brotherhood upgrades at the far plane, you're probably just going to use that. Because that's a 15% strength increase. That's water touch, which is usually not a detriment. And that's sensor, I think. So you can always have an idea of how much of enemy weaknesses and such. Like, the Brotherhood kind of is good for the vast majority of the game. And I think FF10's like equipment system lends itself to that because there's nothing in vanilla equipment that's that spectacular. Like you end up with these there's a lot of reason for the player to put on something that's pretty good and then never think about it again until like very late game. Like at end game, when you have the stuff necessary to do something to make interesting equipment combos, then like that system suddenly becomes really really interesting and gives you some interesting decisions to make, although it also becomes very grindy for certain things, like if you want to get say ribbon. Uh-huh. Like you're going to be grinding for a while, but I do think that I think that's the problem that system runs into, is that it's unengaging in the mid game, and that's honestly where most players are going to spend most of their time. So that's the problem I have with that one. There's some other ones. FF12 sort of tried to like created the situation where like you might be stuck with suboptimal equipment because you hadn't gone in the right direction on the license board to meet the demands of what was nearby. That one's obviously very frustrating to a lot of players. But it's an interesting solution. But ultimately, I guess, like FF7, it had the way that equipment stats might often be put together in such a way that like materia slots were materia slots had something might have more materia slots or better materia growth, but worse stats.
I was thinking about that too, because I remember towards the end of disc one of the original game, you could get a weapon for Cloud Call. I think it was the Nail Bat.
Yeah, the Nail Bat with no materia slots.
Exactly. Much stronger than anything else you could get at the time, but it had no slots for materia, so like, oh, okay.
Yeah, they do that. Curiously, they actually do that with the ultimate weapons as well. I think all of the ultimate weapons have no materia growth at all. They have tons of materia slots and no growth.
I mean, if you're using it at the very end of the game, that you probably have.
Yeah, it makes them a lot. It makes them great for the final dungeon, but it also means that if you're still doing side quests and grinding, you might not want to use them even if you have them, which is an interesting trade-off to put in the player's hands. And then, of course, there's a handful of weapons that have double or triple materia growth, but which have very limited materia slots. So you get a lot of growth on a very limited amount of materia, which is also an interesting decision to put in the player's hands. Ultimately, I think the conclusion we're coming to is the good way to do this is to have them have the equipment interplay with something else in the systems than attack and defense. Like that's that's the commonality between the ones that we seem to like here. So yeah, that's what I'd like to see.
I know we were talking about Final Fantasy, but in Dark Souls, you have the dragon weapons, and those have insanely high base damage, but they have no parameter bonuses from like strength or dexterity. Yeah, there's no scaling. You can't imbue them with other elements. You can't So like the Drake sword is one of the best swords in the game if you get it to +5, but then no parameter bonus. Yeah.
Well, it's one of the best swords in terms of for characters whose only investment in strength is the amount necessary to wield it, it's a very good choice, which is why you get builds in like 3 that revolve around like raw infusion.
Yep.
Because you're trying to not have to scale off of your shitty strength stats. But yeah, non-FF things are, of course, always correct, always worth bringing in here. Is the Brave Blade or the Chicken Knife more thematically appropriate? I mean, you're if you're a Final Fantasy hero, then Brave Blade is probably what you're using.
Yeah.
In terms of how they actually function, especially before the Pixel remasters, you should be taking the Chicken Knife basically every time. Because before the Pixel remasters, there was no way to the Brave Blade could only get worse. Thankfully they finally fixed that with the Pixel remaster. Not running from fights long enough would increase the power of the Brave Blade. I don't think it would decrease the power of the Chicken Knife. They mostly just wanted to fix this. The only mechanical benefit to taking the Brave Blade over the Chicken Knife was that there was no chance that it would fucking cause you to fucking flee, but there was like a million things that existed to make it so that that could never actually happen. How can RPGs encourage you to run away from battles? You got the Chicken Knife or really powerful enemies like Persona's Reaper or Etrian. Foes in Etrian. Like that's kind of the easy way to do it, is to just hit you with something that you cannot possibly win against. Another way you'll see it done is time limits. Sometimes fighting something is just going to take too long.
Yeah.
That can be kind of interesting. But there's really only so many levers you can pull to discourage the player from fighting. You can make it an obvious waste of time by just making it so that, the rewards are slim to none. But that's kind of rare. It's hard to do this diegetically. You kind of just have to you can pull certain other levels to discourage it. I remember there was some old MMO, it might have been like RuneScape or something, that had like a quest where it's like, go and like get X number of enemy pelts, but if you killed too many of them, you would actually fail the quest, because it's like, I didn't tell you to fucking make them go extinct.
Wow.
Which is a funny way of like discouraging it, but it's also, an after the fact thing. It's just like discouraging the player from doing something thoughtlessly. There's something to be said about rewarding different playstyles and making room for a high risk, high reward decision. However, what's the point of the Princess Guard? Just how much risk are you going to take for a power-up? I mean, the Princess Guard is also meant to be thematic, because it's Aerith's best weapon. You get it right as she's about to, leave. And, it's But it's also, you know, there for the same reason that you can get her last limit break after she's already gone. It's to mark the fact that, like, even though because of the game's narrative, her death was inevitable, that doesn't mean it was justified. That doesn't mean it was right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so you get these the thematic choice to include things that are clearly for her, but which she either barely got the chance to use or never got the chance to use, because it's fucked up that she's not there to use them. And if we just mechanically treated everything she doesn't exist anymore, so all of the stuff that she was supposed to use just goes away, like, you lose something. And, like, they could have committed more to that, but I appreciate that, like, you know, that there's anything like that at all, because it's a, you know, it's definitely a game, you know, I think like Sakaguchi at some point yeah, like, it was made, like, he's Sakaguchi's the old myth that went around was that Sakaguchi's mother had died during the production of that game. She had actually died a few years before, but that the themes of loss in FF7 may have been influenced by her death. But, you know, I think a useful thing about making a fictional death stick in that context is to not let the mechanics act as though, oh, well, that was their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, leaving in those things that mark that this shouldn't have happened. But yeah. And of course that also led to many a rumor about how to get her back.
Mm-hmm.
Because she should be here. And as much as those rumors were all wrong, the fact they existed was correct. It was
like General Leo.
Mm-hmm. You should feel like there should have been something you could do, because that's what loss feels like. That's completely afield of the question. I just shoot one from the hip. But yeah. We seem to have managed to hit basically everything that Fireminer put in, and I think we are just about out of time anyway.
Yeah, we should start the rip.
Yep, speed run. Tell me what books I can get if I am a man out of time.
Well, you may be out of time, but it is now time for the Jólabókaflóð, which is the wonderful Icelandic tradition of buying books for yourself or your loved ones to read over Christmas. It is beautiful tradition. We should be doing it around the world. So with that in mind, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. A good 2,600 something pages worth of material according to Kindle Unlimited. So it will keep you busy the entire holiday season. Unless you read like I did when I was in middle school, in which case it'll last you a while anyway. So if you enjoy tabletop role-playing games, but don't have the time and or simply having all of your family over for the holidays prevents you from actually enjoying this sort of thing, you can still enjoy it vicariously through other people's poor dice rolls and poor social decisions. So again, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. And just, you know, just check that name out for other stuff, because there are other books out there with my name on them. So, including Vainglorious Lungs of the Night, Lit RPG, Metroidvania, B-Movie, Have Fun, or Tanuki is a Teapot, Japanese folktales, all about animals. The animals do survive most of these stories. But, you know, folktales, you can't always take that for granted. And then, finally, under a different pen name, Michael Spearwater, we have A Wager for Wanderlust, which, as yet, nobody has read more than 2 pages of on Kindle Unlimited, but partly because I'm just really bad at marketing. So that one is Travelogue by Intent and or Fantasy Travelogue by Intent and Romantasy by Accident. It had a long and varied writing history there.
Human all too human.
Yeah. So anyway, so yes, please for this year's Yule Book Flood, just check out some wonderful stuff to read. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Yeah. Purchase them. Okay. And
buy my book.
Joe, where can we find you?
Well, every Tuesday, Thursday night, I do a live stream for RP Gamer. That's twitch.tv/RPGamer. And I'm still playing Pokemon Legends ZA, so I'm planning streams for Tuesday and Thursday of this week. And then I have a YouTube channel. It's YouTube. It's under Smoke and Joe Gamer. So I got a bunch of videos up there. And I have my own Twitch channel I haven't been getting much use out of, though. And I'm working on doing my annual holiday buying guide, so I'm going to play games that came out this year, do short videos on each one, just let you know what I thought, and if it's worth your time and money and everything else. So I'm going to start working on those videos that'll go straight to YouTube, and then you can follow me on Blue Sky, you can chat with me on Discord if you wanted to, I suppose, and you should check out everything that RP Gamer has to offer. It's a cool website, it's a good community. Some interesting people.
You can join the Discord.
You can. Just don't be creepy.
Don't get yourself kicked out by being an asshole. But yeah, you can join the Discord to ask us questions in the podcast section if you go to rpgamer.com and check the community tab. You can also ask us questions in the stream if you catch it. Normally that's at 9 p.m. or 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern every Monday night. Let's see. We have, and normally that broadcasts on both Ask Wheels and twitch.tv/AskWheels and twitch.tv/RPGamer. There was technical difficulties. We will be back to our regular schedule by the time you hear this.
We hope.
I promise, maybe.
I believe. I'm choosing to believe. I am placing my confidence in Wheels, my entirely unearned confidence. We also have our sister show, Shenanigans. That's usually around 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. Yesterday it was Kirby Air Riders and Pokemon Scarviolet. That was fun. Air Riders is a very good... very good chaos video game. Check those out. But I think that about wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See ya.
Yeah.